What if the cure for a student's paralyzing academic anxiety wasn't a campus therapist, but a really, really well-organized
I
syllabus?
mean, it sounds completely counterintuitive when you frame it that way. We usually think of strict scheduling as the exact opposite of emotional support.
Right, we do. Usually when you and I look at a massive stack of spreadsheets, just rows and rows of university performance data, we expect it to be a bit lifeless.
Oh, absolutely.
It's like looking at the structural blueprints of a house instead of walking through the actual home. You know, averages, percentages, standard deviations.
Just cold, hard math.
Exactly. It's clean, it's binary, and it rarely tells you how people actually felt sitting in that room.
And well, that is usually by design. Academia likes to categorize success with a simple, digestible score.
Yeah, but then you start reading between the lines of this particular data set we have today, and suddenly those cold blueprints start to look like a living, breathing, profoundly human ecosystem. So welcome to this deep dive.
Glad to be here.
Today we are bringing you along as we look at a truly fascinating stack of raw material. We are talking about years and years of university student evaluations, spanning roughly from 2010 to 2016.
That's a huge sample size.
Right. And it's all for a university instructor in South Korea named Giri Bartanis.
And to give you an idea of the scope, we're looking at a really comprehensive set of sources here. Like, these evaluations don't just come from one lucky semester.
Definitely not.
They come from multiple institutions. We've got Hanyang University, Gyeongsang National University, and the Seoul College of General
A
Studies.
lot of ground to cover.
It is. We have quantitative scores, comparative department averages, and pages of translated qualitative student feedback.
So, what is our mission for you today? Well, we are going to carefully analyze these evaluations to build a detailed profile of Giri Bartanis. We want to understand his level of expertise, his compassion, and his application of modern learning theories.
Specifically looking at constructivism and social learning.
Yes. And finally, we're going to synthesize all of this to try and answer one very heavy bottom-line question. Based on this data, is Giri Bartanis a trauma-informed educator?
It's a big question.
It is. Okay, let's unpack this.
Well, to really build this profile accurately, we have to start with the foundation. Because before we can look at how this instructor teaches or how he makes his students feel, we first need to establish if he actually knows what he's doing from a purely structural standpoint.
Right. Like, is he actually a good teacher on paper?
Exactly. We have to look at the hard
And
numbers.
I gotta say, the numbers are staggering. If you've ever looked at university student evaluations, you know they can be brutal.
Oh, completely brutal.
Students are stressed, they're tired, and they often use these anonymous forms to just vent their frustrations. But year after year, semester after semester, Giri consistently scores in the 90s.
It's wild.
Yeah, we're talking A to A plus range across the board.
Yes, but it's not just that his scores are high in isolation. What's fascinating here is how he frequently outperforms the college and department averages.
Right, the relative scores.
Exactly. You see these positive gaps, like a plus 0.43 or a plus 0.66 above the institutional norm.
Let's contextualize that for a second, because a plus 0.66 gap in a 5-point evaluation system is massive.
It really is.
That means in a department where the average professor is scoring, say, a 4.1 out of 5, he is pulling a 4.7 or 4.8.
It is a total statistical outlier. And he's doing this across a really wide variety of courses, which shows broad pedagogical expertise.
Like what kind of courses?
Well, he's teaching basic academic English, professional academic English, critical essay writing, and a course called English Writing with Multimedia.
Wow. To me, it's like a Michelin star restaurant maintaining its elite rating for years, even as the head chef completely overhauls the menu
A
constantly.
great way to put it.
You just can't fake that. It's a sign of deep systemic expertise.
Well,
But I do have to ask the pushback question here.
go for it.
When you see scores this uniformly high across the board, my immediate cynical thought is, are these just easy A classes? Like, are students just padding their GPAs and rewarding a professor who doesn't ask much of them?
Yeah, that's the natural assumption. But what's fascinating here is that the data actually preempts that exact criticism.
Really? How so?
If you look closely at the specific questions where he gets near perfect scores, and we're talking 4.8, 4.9 out of 5, they aren't about his personality or the workload being light. They are about his logistical expertise and structural competence.
Wait, looking at these 4.9 scores on things like syllabus adherence, I mean, couldn't that just mean he's a rigid control freak? How does strict scheduling equal good teaching?
It sounds counterintuitive, I know, but think about it from the perspective of an anxious student. Predictability is a mechanism for safety.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, students gave him top marks on statements like, the course satisfactorily followed the schedule provided in the syllabus, and the instructor prepared for the course thoroughly.
So they knew exactly what to expect.
Exactly. They specifically noted that classes were never canceled without notice, and makeup classes were systematically provided. You don't get a 4.9 in syllabus adherence just by being a fun, easy grading guy.
Right.
You get it by running an incredibly tight ship where the student never has to guess what's coming next.
Okay, I see your point. The predictability removes the chaos.
Yeah.
So the data proves he is highly competent and runs that tight ship.
Definitely.
But we all know that expertise alone can sometimes result in a really cold, rigid classroom.
Yeah.
I mean, you can have a brilliant, perfectly organized professor who is utterly terrifying to actually interact with.
Oh, we've all had one of those.
Absolutely. So to understand his true impact on you, the student, we need to look past those spreadsheet numbers and dig into the qualitative written comments to measure his compassion.
And this is where the profile really starts to become three-dimensional, because the written feedback from the students reveals a classroom environment that is remarkably warm, which beautifully balances out that structural rigidity.
Yeah, I want to read a few of these quotes directly from the translated sources because they paint quite a picture.
Yeah, let's hear them.
One student wrote, "He was so considerate in many ways, especially towards students." Another said, "The professor was always nice and kind, and he also encourages students to express their ideas and thoughts."
That's great feedback.
Right. And I found this one really interesting. "He focuses on students' various abilities."
You know, that last quote is deeply insightful for an undergrad to write. It shows he isn't using a one-size-fits-all approach. He is recognizing them as individuals with different starting lines, rather than just processing them through a syllabus machine.
The theme that really jumped out at me from the translated Korean comments was this pervasive idea of overcoming anxiety.
Right, the language barriers.
Exactly. Over and over, students talked about their fear of English. One student literally used the phrase, "English phobia."
Wow. Phobia is a strong word.
It is. They noted that he specifically helped those who were poor at English gain confidence. Like one student wrote, "Thanks to you, I can become more confident for speaking in front of others."
That is a massive psychological hurdle to clear. The physiology of anxiety is a very real barrier in education.
It really is. I picture his compassion acting like a linguistic safety net. Imagine you are walking a tightrope, which is exactly what trying to speak a second language in front of your native speaking peers feels like.
Oh, it's terrifying.
You are terrified of falling, of looking foolish, of everyone judging your grammar. Gary's kindness is that net below the tightrope. It doesn't make the wire any lower to the ground, like the academic rigor is still there, but it completely removes the paralyzing fear of the fall.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this kind of compassion isn't just a nice personality trait. It is a vital, deliberate teaching tool.
How so?
In linguistics and education, there is a concept called the affective filter. It's essentially an emotional barrier. When a student is anxious, stressed, or afraid of failure, their affective filter goes up, and it literally blocks their brain from acquiring new language or information.
Wait, so if they are scared, it's not just that they don't want to speak, they physically cannot learn.
Exactly. The brain is too busy managing the perceived threat. The amygdala takes over. By deliberately lowering that anxiety through compassion, consideration, and a lack of punishment for mistakes, Gary is lowering their affective filters.
That makes so much sense.
Right. The safety net allows the brain to actually process the vocabulary. It's a pedagogical necessity. And we see the proof of this strategy working in the quantitative data.
In the participation scores, right?
Yes. His scores for the prompt, "I actively participated in class activities," are astronomically high. Students only participate actively when that filter is down.
Okay, so we have a highly compassionate, structurally safe environment. The safety net is securely in place. And according to the sources, this perfectly sets the stage for his actual teaching methodology, which is highly unconventional.
Very much so.
He isn't just standing at a whiteboard lecturing about verbs. He is leaning heavily into modern learning theories. Here's where it gets really interesting.
To see this methodology in action, we really need to focus heavily on the evaluations for a specific course.
Which one?
EWM 15299, which is English Writing with Multimedia. The evaluations for this class are unique because they explicitly ask students about their experience with the constructivist teaching method.
And just to set the scene for you, the listener, This is a class where students are using a whole suite of digital tools.
It's a lot of tech.
Yeah, they are using the Canvas Learning Management System. They are learning Windows Live Movie Maker. They are physically shooting and editing their own videos. And they are setting up and maintaining personal blogs.
Which is an immense cognitive load. Just think about that for a second. They are learning complex editing software, navigating new digital platforms, storytelling, and doing all of it in a second language that they previously had a phobia of.
But their reactions to this social learning model are incredible.
What did they say?
One student wrote, "Working in groups is great. It's more easier to work and creates more creative and brilliant results." Another student captured it perfectly, saying, "Not taking exam and creating own works is the dream class I imagined."
Creating own works. That is the absolute core of constructivism right there.
But I want to pause and push back on this because it seems entirely counterintuitive to human nature.
How so?
Well, some of these students fully admitted the class was incredibly difficult. One said it was hard to adjust and follow the projects. And another jokingly complained in all caps about having too many assignments.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yet they still gave the class perfect top marks. Why do students love a class more when they're forced to do significantly more work, learn complex software, and collaborate rather than just passively sitting in the back row listening to an easy lecture?
That is the hidden magic of constructivism and social learning. In a traditional passive classroom, knowledge is treated as a physical object that the teacher just hands to the student.
Like, here's the fact, memorize it.
Exactly. Here's the grammar rule, put it in your pocket, take this test. It's like reading an IKEA manual. You can read the manual cover to cover, but you don't really know how to build the bookshelf.
That's a great analogy.
Constructivism argues that learners actively construct their own understanding of the world through experiencing things and reflecting on those experiences. Mm. You have to physically build the bookshelf with the tools in your hands.
So they aren't just absorbing, they're actively building. But how does adding the stress of video editing actually help them learn English better?
Yeah.
Wouldn't that just add more anxiety?
It does the exact opposite, actually. Because they are so focused on the complex task of making a cool video or designing their blog, the English language ceases to be a terrifying test they are taking.
Oh, wow.
It simply becomes a tool they are using to accomplish a goal they care about. The multimedia aspect sneaks the language learning past their anxiety.
That's brilliant.
And the social learning aspects, like the group work they praise so highly, means they are learning from each other's mistakes and triumphs. They are peer correcting. The teacher is no longer the sole intimidating authority figure in the room. They are co-creating knowledge together.
It feels like more work because it is deeply active, but it's fundamentally more rewarding because they have ownership over the final product.
See, exactly.
They are invested. And when a student who is terrified of failing suddenly realizes they have ownership and agency, they aren't just learning English anymore. They are healing their relationship with the academic environment, which forces us to look at that heavy bottom line question.
Yes. We've established his systemic expertise, his deep compassion that lowers the effective filter, and his use of student-led constructivist methods. Now it's time to synthesize all of this.
So what does this all mean?
It means we have to evaluate our central mission. Based on everything we've read in these sources, is Gary Bertanis a trauma-informed educator?
I have to admit, I struggle with applying that specific label.
Why is that?
Because if you look at the raw data, the spreadsheets, the translated comments, the sources never explicitly use the clinical word trauma to describe the students. They talk about phobia and anxiety and fear of speaking, but not trauma. Can we really apply that heavy clinical label of trauma-informed to a university English and multimedia instructor without overstepping?
This raises an important question about what trauma-informed education actually looks like in practice outside of a clinical setting.
Right.
It is a very common misconception that being trauma-informed means you are acting as an unlicensed therapist or that you need a clinical diagnosis for every student in your room to justify the approach. That's not what it is at all.
What is it then in a classroom context?
Trauma-informed education is a systemic pedagogical approach based on a set of core pillars. It assumes that anyone in the room might be carrying invisible weight, whether that's severe trauma or just a paralyzing phobia of failure.
And it adjusts for that.
Right. It designs the environment to be universally supportive. The recognized core pillars of a trauma-informed pedagogical framework are safety, trust, choice, collaboration, and empowerment.
Okay, safety, trust, choice, collaboration, empowerment. If we're going to use that label, we need to map those five pillars directly to the source data we've just gone through. Let's start with safety.
Well, we saw safety clearly in his qualitative evaluations. His kindness, the fact that he acts as that safety net under the tightrope.
Yeah.
He doesn't punish mistakes. He encourages them to express their ideas. That is the definition of psychological safety in a learning environment.
And trust. You get trust through consistency. That's the 4.9 score on his syllabus preparation and never canceling a class without notice. The students trust that he is going to be exactly who he says he is every single week. There are no chaotic surprises.
Which brings us to choice. Think about the constructivist multimedia class. He isn't forcing them all to write the exact same essay on the exact same prompt.
Right, they were picking their own topics.
They have the choice and autonomy to design their own video projects, to choose their topics and maintain their own personal blogs. They have agency over their learning path.
Actually, there's a quote from the sources that perfectly encapsulates that. One of the students evaluating the multimedia course wrote, "I think the freedom and flexibility that comes with the constructivist method proved to be very effective. I was able to work with much more control."
Much more control. That is everything. Giving a student control is the antidote to the helplessness that fuels anxiety.
That makes total sense.
And that naturally leads into the fourth pillar, which is collaboration. We read the quotes. "Working in groups is great, creates more creative and brilliant results. He is actively fostering social connections so students aren't isolated in their struggle."
And finally, empowerment.
How do you see empowerment in the data?
That's the English phobia cure. Taking a student who is utterly terrified to speak, giving them the multimedia tools and the safety net, and getting them to the point where they leave the semester saying, "Thanks to you, I can become more confident for speaking English in front of others."
Wow.
They didn't just learn vocabulary, they fundamentally changed how they view their own capabilities.
When you lay the hard data and the student comments over those five pillars, the alignment is striking. The safety of his compassion, the trust in his logistical expertise, the choice and collaboration inherent in his constructivist methods, and the ultimate empowerment of his students.
So it's a perfect match.
It is. So to answer the question unequivocally, yes. The data paints a clear, undeniable picture of a trauma-informed educator at work, even if the word trauma is never spoken in his classroom.
It really is an incredible journey to take through a stack of what initially looked like dry spreadsheets. We started by looking at raw data, standard deviations, and college averages.
Just blueprints.
Exactly. But by looking closely and reading between the lines of those metrics, we uncovered a highly effective, compassionate, and constructivist teaching philosophy that doesn't just grade students. It fundamentally empowers them to overcome their fears.
It highlights the value of looking past the grades to see the human impact of education. The data always tells a story if you know how to read it.
It does. And we hope this deep dive has reminded you to look for the human stories inside the metrics you deal with every day. The blueprints are important, but the life lived inside the house is what actually matters.
Well said.
We want to leave you with a final thought to mull over today. We've just seen the data on how a single educator can completely rewrite a student's relationship with learning, like how they can essentially eliminate academic anxiety simply by shifting from a top-down authority figure to a compassionate co-creator.
Yeah.
So think about this. What would happen if our entire educational system adopted this constructivist trauma-informed model by default rather than just by exception?
Imagine the potential.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. We'll see you next time.